love. Today, we are going to explore the philosophical concept of intersubjectivity. With me is Professor Christian DeQuincy, who is Dean of Consciousness Studies at the University of Philosophical Research. He is also on the faculty of John F. Kennedy University and Sophia University. He is the founder and director of the Wisdom Academy and author of many books, including Radical Nature, Radical Knowing, Deep Spirit, Cracking the Noetic Code, a novel, Consciousness, From Zombies to Angels, and Blind Spots. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
It's good to be with you. Intersubjectivity, it sounds like a sociological concept in a way, but we'll be discussing it, I suppose, as an epistemology. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It does have sociological applications and implications. We're going to be talking about it, I'm assuming, from the perspective of philosophy, as a philosophical perspective.
Since you're a philosopher, that would make sense. And let's define for our viewers, what is an epistemology?
Okay, an epistemology is really an exploration of how we can know anything. Epistemology is the study of how we know what we think we know, mm-hmm. and how do we know.
Yeah. Now, for example, we've done a previous interview on an ontology, being panpsychism. Mm-hmm. Ontology is different from epistemology.
Correct. Ontology is the study of the nature of being, or the study of the nature of reality. And then epistemology is, how do we know what reality is? Or how do we know what being is? So here the focus is on our knowingness, mm-hmm. or our method of knowing, as opposed to what we know. So epistemology is how we know. Ontology is what we know, is one mm-hmm. way of thinking of it.
Well, and intersubjectivity being an epistemology, what are some of the other epistemologies we might contrast it with?
Well, the dominant epistemology is really, again, it comes from the French philosopher Descartes, is the idea of subjectivity, is that we are individual egos, individual units of consciousness, that to communicate with each other, we need to exchange signals and symbols and communicate, which is basically requiring some degree of objective medium between individuals for the communication to take place. So it's air vibrations, if we're speaking, or the telephone or the internet. So there is some physical medium that's required for two individuals to communicate. Intersubjectivity rejects the idea that we are fundamentally isolated individuals and that our deepest nature is relationship. For example, the subtitle of my book, Radical Knowing, is Understanding Consciousness Through Relationship. Mm-hmm. And it makes the point and presents arguments to defend the idea that our deepest nature is not that we are isolated, unique individuals, but that our deepest nature is relationship. It doesn't deny our individuality, but it basically says our individuality is something that comes secondary to our fundamental nature, which is interbeing, as the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh would say, mm-hmm. is that our deepest nature is interbeing. Philosophically, intersubjectivity is the way to describe that. And so the way that we communicate is, again, through feeling and telepathic sharing of meaning, mm-hmm. as opposed to verbal exchanges of signals.
Now, Descartes, of course, is famous for having said, I think, therefore I am, mm-hmm. which seems to be holding his own subjectivity up as the very ground of his being.
Yes, it is. And that actually raises an interesting distinction that I cover in my books, is the different meanings of subjectivity. There is the Cartesian notion of subjectivity, of us as atomistic, isolated individuals, mm-hmm. as our primary nature. And then there's the other meaning of subjectivity, which is the experience of being. That sense of interiority, that there is a feeling within us, mm-hmm. that we call consciousness or experience, then that's primary. I think Descartes got it right on that score, that there, that our deepest nature, at least our deepest nature, involves this capacity for experience. Where I think he got it wrong is to suggest that this capacity for experience is kind of bundled up into isolated atomistic individuals, mm-hmm. and that we need to come together like atoms forming molecules if we're going to be in relationship. Mm-hmm. Intersubjectivity turns that around and says, no, our deepest nature is relationship, and out of this web or matrix or ocean of interbeing, of ocean of intersubjectivity, our individuality arises like a wave out of an ocean. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, it doesn't deny the idea of intersubjectivity or the idea, excuse me, the idea of individuality.
Yes.
But it points out that our individuality is a manifestation of a deeper aspect of our reality, mm-hmm. which is our intersubjectivity.
We live in modern Western culture, and particularly in the United States, is very individualistic. I think a lot of people struggle to define themselves as individuals apart from the kind of tribal or social mentalities that they often feel like we're being squeezed into, forced into, that we have to conform. But you're talking about something completely different here, I think.
Well, in a way, the sociological problems arise from the philosophical assumptions that we can trace back to Descartes. Mm-hmm. The idea that we are, that our deepest nature is that we are individuals, that has given rise to the sociological phenomenon most prominently in the United States of the Lone Ranger syndrome, is that we're going to go it alone, and that's the way to be successful. So there are sociological implications from accepting or buying into the Cartesian notion of the isolated individual, mm-hmm. that intersubjectivity tries to correct.
Yeah. Now, I have, in addition to my parapsychology background, I happen to have a master's degree in criminology, one of the social sciences. And when I studied sociology back in the 1970s, the dominant mode of sociology, even in this very individualistic American culture, frankly, it was Marxist. Mm-hmm. And the Marxist vision of human identity was essentially that our identities are defined by the power structures in which we live, by the major institutions. That would be a way of thinking of intersubjectivity, which struck me at the time as being very limited. It like seemed to deny any psychological depth to people, that we were totally conditioned by the patriarchal power structures. So when you're talking about intersubjectivity, you're thinking about relationship in a very different way than a Marxist would look at it.
Right. It doesn't completely reject the Marxist perspective, but it transcends and includes that, to use a Hegelian phrase. Mm-hmm. Basically, remember that Marxism is dialectical materialism. Mm-hmm. So Marx was buying into the scientific materialist perspective. And so for him, relationship was a relationship, again, through objective physical exchanges. Intersubjectivity is recognizing that not only are we related to each other physically, but we are related to each other non-physically through consciousness. Physical relationships can be described in terms of mechanisms, exchanging energy from one point in space to some other point in space, whereas intersubjectivity is recognizing that we are also related through meaning, mm-hmm. through consciousness, mm-hmm. which is not mechanistic. It is a relationship through meaning.
Language seems to be an environment that unites us all. We're speaking the English language mm-hmm. with each other right now. Our viewers are, for the most part, all listening to the English language, although there will be hopefully closed captioning, so people will actually be able to listen to us or watch our words being translated mm-hmm. into many languages. Mm-hmm. I hope that's available when people are viewing this. Maybe not right away, it will be.
Okay.
But in any case, let's talk about language as the environment that connects us, and how that relates to the philosophy of intersubjectivity.
Right. So the philosophy of intersubjectivity would say that our deepest mode of communication is non-physical, is telepathic, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's an exchange of meaning through feeling.
Yeah.
And that we...
Not linguistic.
That linguistic is there, but it's not the deepest nature of our communication.
Mm-hmm.
That clearly we do communicate and relate to each other through language. But even if you and I were to sit here in silence for the rest of our time together, we would still be communicating and communing with each other, you know, whether it's silently through body language, and that's still a perception. But we would also be feeling each other's presence, that there would be a relationship through the intersubjective co-creation of our own being that's taking place. And so language, like thinking, is something that is an evolution or something that is a product of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
A phrase that I often use in my work and my writing and my lectures is that feeling comes first. Feeling comes before thinking. That every thought, and therefore every word, that has ever existed first began as a feeling, an embodied feeling in somebody's being. And out of, like, if we think back in terms of evolution or in terms of our own individual development, long before humans evolved with their neocortex that gave them the capacity for communicating in language, our ancestors, our pre-human ancestors, connected with each other through feeling, and we felt our way through the world. When we were infants, before we had language, we still had feeling. We felt the warmth of the sun on our bodies. We felt hungry. We felt the presence of our caregiver and so on. So we had these feelings long before those feelings were codified into thoughts and language. So feeling comes first. And part of what I try to emphasize in my book, Radical Knowing, is that we need to pay attention to the relationship between our feeling being and our thinking being. Whereas most modern education and philosophy focuses on the thinking aspect, not on the feeling aspect. What I'm trying to do in my work as a philosopher is to revalidate the importance of the epistemology of feeling, that we can know who we are and we can know where we are in the world and how we are related to other beings around us by paying attention to our embodied sensations, to our feelings, not getting lost in the abstractions of thought.
Mm-hmm. One might even say then that our words are pointers to that deeper feeling level.
They can be.
Mm-hmm.
They can also be shields or blockages from feeling.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, I think that happens far too frequently, is that we get lost in the abstractions of thought and language and don't any longer pay sufficient attention to our embodied feelings and sensations, which are informing us at a pre-verbal level of our relatedness to the world around us, to our environment, which includes other sentient beings.
I suppose a Freudian or a depth psychologist might say we sometimes use words as a way of defending ourselves against our feelings, against being overwhelmed.
Yes.
By our feelings. And, you know, as a parapsychologist, when you mentioned telepathy, for example, I think that we often insulate ourselves from our own telepathy because opening up to all the pain in the world can overwhelm somebody.
Yes, it can. And so we can rationalize that by using our capacities for thinking and language to avoid deeper feeling.
Mm-hmm.
However, if we're going to solve the kinds of problems that we have in the world today, we need to feel that pain, I believe. We need to feel the grief of what our, not so much our species, but our industrial and post-industrial civilization is doing to the rest of the environment, that we need to pay attention to the distress within our own psyches, with our own embodiment, as well as, of course, the distress we're causing to other creatures.
Is there a way to get in touch with that, though, without being overwhelmed by it?
I think the overwhelm is probably a part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to do is to learn to feel the overwhelm, feel our way deeply into the grief, feel our way deeply into the pain. And only by doing so are we likely to come up with the kinds of actions that we need to take to correct the problems that we have created.
Well, I know there's a lot of joy in the world as well. It's not all pain, but the pain does seem to be almost endless. Just for example, I'm pretty sure that on this planet there are maybe 1 million people who die every day.
Yeah.
So they're experiencing their death agonies, not to mention other animals, even species, that are being exterminated practically by the day. It would seem to me that to open oneself up to feeling the world, I mean, the pain alone can be almost endless, even though the pain is maybe only 50% of it.
Well, yes, and there's something in another conversation we had. We talked about process philosophy.
Yeah.
Well, there's also a process epistemology, if you like, is that it's important for us to allow ourselves to feel the depth of our pain and to feel it fully, because only by going through the grief and the fear and the pain can we then come out whole the other side, and that's where joy exists. As long as we try to suppress the fear and the pain and the agony and the grief, we won't be open to the joy that exists in the world. As I have mentioned in other conversations, that the philosopher that has impressed me most in my work is Alfred North Whitehead.
Yes.
And he talks about how that every sentient being has an aim or a purpose. And it's the common aim and purpose to every sentient being, not just humans, but every sentient being, is the experience of satisfaction, of feeling complete in the moment. So the feeling of satisfaction is the positive aspect of what we can feel our way to. But if we are blocking satisfaction, there's going to be pain along the way, and we need to experience that pain to break through the blockage and then experience the satisfaction, whether it's our own personal satisfaction or the satisfaction of all the other beings that we are in relationship with.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of interesting phrases here. Every sentient being, it sort of echoes from Buddhism. And earlier you referred to Buddhism as well. And I know a phrase from Buddhism that has often struck me in terms of our understanding of reality. They use a phrase that translates into English roughly as mutually dependent arising. There is no such thing in Buddhism, as I understand it, as a self. It's an illusion. It only exists because of its mutual dependency with the rest of existence.
Yes, and of course, this is a very deep topic, and we could spend many hours and even then not exhaust its implications. In my reading and understanding of Buddhism, it doesn't, at least in some forms of Buddhism, they don't deny the self, but they say the self is not our deepest nature, which again comes back to the perspective of intersubjectivity I was talking about earlier, is that our deepest nature is relationship. So to say that we are in relationship with all other sentient beings is to say that our deepest nature is that relationship. And that is very much consistent with the Buddhist perspective, that we have a self is one way of talking about it. We do have a self, but we are not the self. The self is not who we are, but it is something that we possess. Or if you like, the ego is something that we possess, but it is not ultimately who we are. A phrase that I often use to describe that is, we are not who we think we are. And that operates on a few levels of ambiguity. We are not who we think we are.
Well, some Buddhists, including the psychologist Susan Blackmore, describe the self as nothing but a concept that we have, a small concept that in what one might think of as a much larger psyche.
I would agree with that. Where I wouldn't go is to say that consciousness, as distinct from self, is an illusion. Because if we go there, we're opening up a really thorny issue of, well, who is having the illusion, mm-hmm. if not some conscious sentient being? Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can throw out consciousness and sentience and experience.
As some philosophers might attempt to do.
As eliminative materialists, for example, yeah, vocally
do. Susan Blackmore, to whom I referred, is often aligned.
Right, exactly. Yes. So I would not accept that perspective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would accept the implication that our deepest nature is not this individual self. Mm-hmm. But I say that the notion of experience, of consciousness, that gives rise to a sense of self is real and has mm-hmm. to be acknowledged as part of mm-hmm. who we are and as part of reality.
When we talk about epistemology, how we know things, often think of mystics who claim to have direct awareness of the essence, the essential nature of everything, and to feel themselves one with everything. Mm-hmm. That sounds very close to what you're referring to as intersubjectivity.
I think it is. I think at those levels of high mystical experience, what's happening is that they have either seen through or transcended the illusion that who they are is their individual being, and their feeling now. Remember that feeling is the primary mode of knowing mm-hmm. that all sentient beings have, is that their feeling is now opened up to feeling the oceanic presence of feeling throughout the cosmos, mm-hmm. and that it's often described as that oceanic feeling. So the wave has allowed itself to merge back into the ocean and identify with all that is, with all sentient beings.
Mm-hmm. You've used the term feeling quite a bit now, and I have the impression, Christian, that you're referring to feeling in a different way than is often used by psychologists who would talk about the limbic system of the brain and the mammalian brain. And you don't mean that feeling quite the way a dog or a cat feels, or do you?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. It would include the way a dog and a cat feels, but it doesn't mean emotion. And I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people I've noticed when I use the word feeling, what they're hearing is I'm using the word emotion. Mm-hmm. But I don't mean that. I mean the embodied sensations. What is happening in our bodies? Mm-hmm. To pay attention to those sensations. That's what I mean by feeling. Mm-hmm. An emotion is awareness of those feelings plus some cognitive interpretation of those feelings. So, for example, sitting here having conversation with you, my heart might be beating fast, yes. my palms might be a little sweaty. Mm-hmm. Those are the sensations, those are the feelings, the beating heart, the sweaty palms. And I then have an interpretation, oh, I'm nervous. That's a cognitive overlay on my mm-hmm. feelings. But I could have exactly the same sensations, exactly the same feelings, and have a different cognitive interpretation. Oh, I'm excited to be here in your presence. Yes. In the first case, the emotion would be fear or anxiety. Mm-hmm. In the second case, it would be excitement. Mm-hmm. So the emotion is feeling plus some cognitive component.
The Buddhists have a phrase called mindfulness mm-hmm. associated with a Vipassana meditation, but it sounds very similar, being aware of just what is happening.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It's Vipassana is what is happening in your body, mm-hmm. but also the thoughts and the emotions that mm-hmm. are being processed as well. So you could think of Vipassana as holistic mm-hmm. awareness. It's paying attention to what's happening in our body, as well as what's happening in our mind, our consciousness.
And this fundamentally is what you seem to be saying is how we know the world.
Yes, it is. That we fundamentally know through feeling our relatedness to other feeling sentient beings.
Mm-hmm. Now, in some mystical traditions, you have in yoga and Kundalini yoga, I'm thinking of meditators who focus very, very carefully on their bodily sensations and have come up with I would call it an internal map or an internal cosmology. It involves chakras, it involves organs that are not visible to normal physiologists, the nadis and energies of the body, the koshas, and these are all described in enormous detail in some of the ancient scriptures of Kundalini yoga. Is that, are they going too far? Would you consider that to be an expression of intersubjectivity.
I would consider that to be certainly consistent with the philosophy of intersubjectivity. The philosophy of intersubjectivity itself is consistent with the philosophy of panpsychism, and panpsychism is consistent with the notion that there are different levels of being, that there are subtle energies. Mm-hmm. So we have a subtle body as well as our gross, visible, physical body. We have this internal body, if you like, the subtle body. And what Kundalini work is referring to is the flow of these subtle energies through our system.
Precisely.
And by being aware of that, mm-hmm. and there are certain nodes where different qualities will be manifested in that subtle body. And so I'm totally open to the validity of that work.
Mm-hmm. And you seem to be suggesting furthermore that if someone attempts to approach the world strictly through what we call rationality, they're missing a great deal.
Yes, indeed. And that brings up another topic. I hope we have enough time to go into it.
Okay. We have about a minute.
Okay. Which is the distinction between pre-conquest and post-conquest consciousness.
Yes.
Pre-conquest consciousness is the consciousness of indigenous peoples where they relate to each other through feeling, as opposed to post-conquest consciousness, which is relating to each other through dialectic, through words, through rationality. And so basically what I'm saying in my work is that we need to relate to each other primarily through feeling our relationship with other people rather than trying to think it through. And that's the consequences of living from our heads as opposed to living from our embodied feeling. Are deep and have profound implications for our relationships with other human beings, but also our relationship with other sentient beings and the world around us.
Right, and you've used the word conquest here, suggesting that in all cultures, the conquerors who have often wiped out indigenous cultures on every continent, almost every continent, in order to become a conqueror, they seem to cut themselves off from their feelings.
Exactly. Yeah, they're operating from the abstractions of rationality. Mm-hmm. One way of thinking about it is that the industrial mindset is a dialectical. It's communicating ideas and looking for how they confront each other and clash with each other, contrasted with the indigenous mode of consciousness, which is dialogical. It's that we are feeling our relatedness to the other person we're communicating with or the other beings that we're communicating with.
Christian DeQuincy, thank you so much for being with me. It's been a very enlightening conversation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for being with us.